This reflection on the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector is one of a series on Jesus' parables, and I hope that you find them helpful and food for thought. The parable is found in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, but those who humble themselves will be exalted. Everyone loves an underdog story, and it probably took Jesus under 90 seconds to tell this one. But this short story had a sting in its tail. Now, for us to understand it fully, there are a couple of things we've got to have in place. First, Jesus's original audience was Jewish, and they knew that any visit to the temple at Jerusalem was, in effect, an approach to God. The men in the story were coming to talk with God. The second thing is that both men served as representatives of their respective communities. And you simply couldn't imagine two communities that were more different from each other. Here's how they faced off. Pharisees were respected. Tax collectors were despised. Pharisees chose exclusion. Tax collectors were excluded. Pharisees taught the law of Moses. Tax collectors enforced the law of Rome. Pharisees counted sins. Tax collectors counted shekels. Pharisees prayed in public. Tax collectors prayed on the public. Pharisees observed fasts. Tax collectors organized feasts. Pharisees did religion. Tax collectors didn't. I think it's safe to assume that these guys didn't share a taxi on their trip to the temple. Well, naturally enough, it's the Pharisee who's first to pray. He stood by himself and he prayed about himself. And as we listen to him pray, we hear that he was keen to talk to God about two things: other people's sins and his righteousness. Do you get the impression that these two topics might just have been his favourite topics of conversation? The Pharisee tried the oldest trick in the book. He mounted his moral high horse and wagged his finger at those around him on account of their loose living, our tax collector included. God was bound to be impressed. Surely God could see that he belonged to an entirely different category of men. But leaving nothing to chance, and just in case God had been looking the other way, he reminded the Lord of his rigorous regime of fasting and tithing. That should seal the deal. I'm not as bad as others, and don't forget all those credits that I have accumulated. Now, if we caught what Luke wrote as he set the scene for our story, alarm bells will be ringing. Here's the context. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. The Pharisee was guilty on both counts. His smug satisfaction with himself ran alongside his sneering contempt for others. This is religious self-righteousness in concentrated form. It plays to our pride by telling us that so long as we try to follow the rules and manage better than most, then we can take our chances with God. There are, however, two great problems with the "I'm not that bad, I think I'm quite good" approach to God. The first is the matter of our sin. Did you notice the complete absence of an acknowledgement of personal sin in the Pharisee's prayer? Don't misunderstand me, he may well have been telling the truth when he claimed to have avoided those more flagrant violations of the law that he was very happy to itemize. But what about those lesser sins? What about his jealous thoughts? His lustful desires? His convenient lies? His hurtful words? What about his arrogance and pride? What about the good he had failed to do? What about his lack of compassion? His disregard for the weak? His disdain for the broken? Is God so busy looking at adulterers and evildoers and tax collectors that he fails to notice those infringements of his law? The Apostle Paul doesn't think so. Romans 3:23, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." But the self-righteous face a second problem. It's not only that a holy God will never miss or ignore our sin, it's also that our very best efforts to live righteously will always fall short. Whether you're a turbo tither like our Pharisee or just the person who doesn't do anyone any harm, do you really think this will be enough to bring you to God? If that is your thinking, you'll need to explain what God was doing at Calvary. For if by our good works and our decent living we could reconnect with God, then the crucifixion of Jesus was a tragic and unnecessary sideshow. Once again, Paul spells it out. Galatians 2:21, he says this, "I do not set aside the grace of God. For if righteousness came by the law, by our good works, then Christ died for nothing." No, if the solution lay within our grasp, why send Jesus? If we could deal with sin by ourselves, why the cross? If salvation, if acceptance with God could be earned, why pour out grace? There really are no satisfactory answers to those questions. Sometimes body language tells us all we need to know. If our Pharisee could stride in, stand apart, puff his chest out, and lift his eyes to heaven, then the prayer that follows comes as no surprise. He walked the walk, and he talked the talk. But the contrast with the tax collector couldn't be more marked. Here's a man who felt he shouldn't come close, who wouldn't look up, and who couldn't stop pounding his chest as he talked to God. Do you get the impression that this was his first visit to the temple and his first prayer for quite some time? Well, if it had taken him a long time to pray, he didn't pray for long. Was it the shortest prayer of his life? It was certainly the most significant. It was direct, sincere, and urgent. Above everything else, it was a plea for something. The one thing, in fact, that the Pharisee felt no need of whatsoever. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. The tax collector needed mercy, like a drowning man needs air. He couldn't live the life he was living one day more. The weight of sin was crushing, his burden of guilt overwhelming. His conscience condemned him for his past and warned him of his future. He had no excuses to offer, no defense to make, and no chips to bargain with. He had come to an end of himself. He was spent. And having come to face himself, he knew it was time to face God. But how? On what grounds could he approach a holy God? By merit or by mercy? If the Pharisee felt he had a choice to make, the tax collector understood he had none. If you have nothing to give, then your only hope is to receive. So with every fibre of his being, he cast himself upon the mercy of God. And Jesus Christ, the embodiment of that mercy, declared him justified before God on that basis. Our tax collector had grasped something that so many religious people fail to see. If he was ever going to be made right with God, then it would be God's doing and not his. God requires our repentance. He refuses our assistance. The message of the New Testament is that God's salvation is freely available in Jesus Christ, but only sinners need apply. After all, if you don't see yourself as a sinner, what use is a Savior? As Jesus said, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. The problem with the Pharisee was he couldn't see the problem. And not even God can save someone like that. The Bible warns that if we adopt an attitude like that and refuse to take responsibility for our disobedience to God, we exclude ourselves from his offer of forgiveness through Jesus. Choices have consequences. Retain your pride. Preserve your self-righteousness. But keep your sin. And that's precisely the principle that Jesus said his story illustrated. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but those who humble themselves will be exalted. So both men made their way home. For the Pharisee, nothing had changed. He left the temple just as he had arrived, trusting in himself. He had no need of mercy, no space for grace, and no time to waste. Now he must hurry. There were laws to keep and tithes to count. After all, the treadmill of self-righteousness won't turn by itself. How different it all was for the tax collector. He returned home justified before God. Mercy flooded his soul. He had been forgiven and he knew it. No more guilt for the past. No more fear for the future. He was right with God. We understand that life would never be the same again. I first met Tomac at an end-of-term barbecue at our house. And I was immediately impressed by his impeccable manners and just the sheer appreciation for the invitation to join us. And as our night together progressed, we were getting on really well. Towards the end of the evening, I said to the students that I had a simple English lesson for them just before they left, and I can still hear their groans. But when I told them that I would explain the difference between biblical Christianity and religion in just two short words, that sparked their interest. I held up two small cards with the little word do written on one and done on the other. Over the next few minutes, I explained that religion, even if it calls itself Christianity, will always place the burden on us. We must obey. We must improve. We must attain. Ultimately, it's down to us. The true message of the Bible, however, is that Jesus has done it all for us. Salvation is God's gift to undeserving sinners. It's something we could never earn, but can receive freely by repenting of our sin and trusting in Jesus. Some moments after I'd finished, Tomac approached me and he asked if we could chat. For privacy, we walked away from the group and stood in the garden. Jeff, I heard what you said in there, and I understood it. Great start, I thought. But then things started to change, and Tomac became quite agitated. No, that's too easy. I want to get better. I want to improve. I want to reach higher. Tomac was now standing on his tiptoes with an arm pointing to the sky. And there was no doubt that he meant every word he said. Tomac desperately wanted to make himself right with God. With my new friend still straining vertically, I said, Tomac, could I ask you a personal question? And he nodded his permission. How's that going for you? I'll never forget the next few moments as Tomac performed a convincing impression of a punctured balloon. He folded because it was just so obvious to him and to me that the graceless grip of religion was a hard taskmaster. His progress hadn't been sufficient. His efforts were not enough. Time passed. About 9 months later, I was manning the door and welcoming the students to class when a familiar face came bounding towards me. "Goodness, Tomek, you've some spring in your step tonight." His reply will never leave me. And why shouldn't I? For I'm saved. Religion had lost another slave. Grace had won.